Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and I think I've shared with you that I'm planning a trip to South Africa in March of this year. I'm going with a friend, Althea Johnson, and her husband. Althea is a wheelchair user, and so this presents some special challenges, and obviously we want her to be well and to have a good time. So we're doing a lot of extra planning that we thought we would share with you so that you can benefit from the process that we're going through. Even if you're just flying domestically for a couple of hours, it can be helpful to go through these hints. And listening to our experience will hopefully generate some thinking for you. Coming up in the next hour, we have three very interesting people for you to talk with. One is Eric Lipp, who is the executive director of the Open Doors organization out of Chicago that works with members of the travel industry to increase accessibility for handicapped people. Second, we have Althea Johnson, my friend from New York, who is going to be going with me to South Africa. And third, her friend Angela D'Arezzo from New York also. Both she and Angela are volunteers for the International Center for the Disabled, and Angela has done quite a bit of long-distance travel herself. So we're going to be learning from these three people how to go on a trip and have a wonderful time, no matter what abilities or disabilities you are taking along. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clenton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. So let me introduce to you Eric Lipp, who is the executive director of the Open Doors organization in Chicago. Welcome, Eric.
You've really made a big impact on the travel industry.
Yeah, thanks.
What was it that inspired you to start Open Doors?
Well, having spent some time at the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago after having surgery, to have a tumor removed from my spinal cord, I used a wheelchair, and I found it very difficult to go out even around the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago and just go to get food or go to visit my friends. So I decided to really teach businesses on how to let people with disabilities get out of the house. A lot of times focusing on kind of travel, hospitality, entertainment, because that's really one of the major reasons why people do go out of the house.
Right, to go out to dinner with their friends or something.
Right, simple things. And we felt by educating businesses on what accessibility is all about would be a great approach for this.
And even though there are laws and incentives, they don't necessarily apply to all businesses. So those incentives aren't enough.
You know, a lot of times those incentives are not exactly what the businesses might want or had expected. However, there's also, you know, in the ADA, the Reasonable Accommodation.
The Americans with Disabilities Act.
Correct.
As a provision for making reasonable accommodation in the workplace. Is that what you mean?
Yes, and a lot of times the reasonable accommodation includes not putting any undue or heavy fee so that the business might not be able to succeed. A lot of times you're able to find a reasonable accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and you know, you can usually find a middle ground for accessibility. That's what it encourages, anyway. Not to say that there's not plenty of lawsuits out there.
Right. But simple things like making sure that a paid telephone is low enough that someone in a wheelchair could use it.
Yeah, or how about at a hotel, making sure that the water controls for the shower are close to the bench that somebody's going to be sitting on.
Uh-huh.
Or things in hotels like having the same, the shampoo bottle and the conditioner and the mouthwash, all the little bottles look the same, but somebody who's blind or low vision would have no idea how to differentiate those.
I have a hard time with that myself.
Me too. Some of the shampoos and conditioners these days smell a little bit like mouthwash, so it's hard to distinguish between them all.
Well, and sometimes they're in tiny little print in gold on a white liquid, and it's almost impossible to read it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are a lot of things like that that businesses are not necessarily sensitive to, and if they were sensitized, maybe they could just order it up a little differently for the same price.
Yeah, it's usually not very expensive to make necessary or simple adjustments to your business to create accessibility. And that's kind of the big myth. You know, everybody thinks it's going to be some harsh, undue kind of expense. And while it might be some expense, usually they found the expense to be around $500 to $1,000. I think that was a statistic that was done by one of the government agencies a few years back. But I think that there's just a big myth, and there's a lot of fear there, too, because the biggest fear amongst businesses is, we want to do it, but what if we're doing it wrong? And they're really afraid to do it because they don't want to do it wrong. Because then
right.
They feel like that could cause big problems as well.
Right, and sometimes there are big expenses. Like if you have a building that was built in the 19th century and now you need to add an elevator, that could cost you $100,000 or something like that.
Yeah, and getting back to travel, same with airports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might find out that adding on to an airport isn't that easy because of the way the structure is built and the size.
Mm-hmm.
Same with hotels, restaurants too. You know, there's here in Chicago, we have restaurants that have a few stairs to get in them or go down them. I mean, some very, very well-known popular tourist sites that are in buildings that are so old that it's nearly impossible to create accessibility or full accessibility for that matter.
Right. So there's two dimensions of challenges. One is building a building new correctly from the ground up, and the other one is retrofitting an older building where sometimes it's difficult even to figure out where one could put an elevator.
Yeah. It takes a little bit of thought. It takes really good design. That's usually what I always talk about is design, because I believe design really pushes accessibility. Especially in the travel industry, design of hotels, museums, even aircraft. Just
mm-hmm.
If you have good design, then you really create accessibility. And that's just not for people with disabilities. That's for everybody.
Now, one of the things I've seen you talk about is the number of travelers with some sort of disability that are out there and how much money they spend on travel. So this is not just a small minority of people. It's actually a pretty sizable dimension.
Oh, yeah. I mean, our market study here at Open Doors shows that people with disabilities spend about $13.6 billion a year on travel alone, and that is represents a huge number for the industry, as well as we represent about 4% of the airline industry revenues a year and about 4% of hotel industry revenues per year. So that makes us really one of their biggest segments. There's really no other minority that can state claim to any kind of numbers such as that. People with disabilities eat out at least once a week. We book on the web our trips and vacations. We book at a higher rate than the general population. So people with disabilities are more likely to go to your website, find out information, and even book right on there. And we're really a strong group that has a lot of money that's spread out over, you know, a lot of different people.
Right, and this is some people who are quadriplegic or paraplegic or have spinal cord injuries like your own, but there are also just a lot of aging people for whom it's hard to walk a long distance where they may need a wheelchair situationally in an airport, for example. Instead of walking the half mile between gates, they may ask for wheelchair assistance.
Sure, that the amount of wheelchair assistance that goes on at airports right now is really staggering. One of the biggest airlines that operates out of Chicago's O'Hare, they can do up to like 1,500 wheelchair pushes a day.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so it's really a big service that the industry provides to people.
Yeah, I've noticed that there are usually at least one or two on the flights that I take.
Yeah, you know, just about, if you look around now, everywhere you go, from restaurants to museums to hotels, you're going to be able to find about 20% of the people, if you look around, will have some sort of disability. And that's visible disability, so there's all kinds of hidden disabilities as well. But you're going to be able to walk into a restaurant and see people with disabilities. You're going to go to the nation's airports and you're going to see people using wheelchairs.
Mm-hmm.
I just came back from a trip to Legoland outside of San Diego, and I saw plenty of people with disabilities there, from visual to mobility.
Well, and it's nice when a park like that really makes an effort to accommodate people with some sort of handicap so that they can have a fun experience, and their whole family, therefore, has a more fun experience.
Yeah, you know, however, amusement parks in general, you know, we were talking about the ADA, and it's funny because they actually don't have to adhere to the ADA. So amusement parks in general are not that accessible, believe it or not. Like, their public facilities are, their restrooms probably, but rides, ironically, are not covered. So only about 60% of rides at Walt Disney World are going to be accessible. So I think that runs pretty close to the, actually it's going to be a little bit higher than most other parks, in fact, to be perfectly frank. Disney, their 60% is probably a little bit higher than some of the others.
Right. And there are dimensions and dimensions of disability. So just thinking in terms of rides, to make it accessible for someone who's visually impaired but has mobility is a different challenge than making it accessible for someone who has a mobility disorder and maybe doesn't even transfer out of a wheelchair. So you have to figure out how to accommodate a wheelchair, and that's much more difficult than transferring them into the little chain of little vehicles that takes you around that ride.
Yeah, it's not just about mobility disabilities. I mean, you're talking about descriptive captioning.
Right.
Disney has rides where they have descriptive captioning for people who are blind, which goes beyond, you know, Braille or a large print. It's literally a full explanation of what the person might be seeing in, say, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride.
So you'd have a headset that gives you that narration?
Yeah, exactly. I think it might do it in the Hall of Presidents, too, so it describes the scene and then you can hear it. As well as some of them have closed captioning. Disney has a really cool device where if you need captioning, you have a little acrylic panel, and it might sit right in front of you in the theater, and from behind you, the captioning is being projected onto that acrylic panel, like a laser. Yeah, really cool technology.
So that would be for someone who's hearing impaired.
Right, right. So, you know, a place like Disney is thinking about everybody. I wish I could say that about all attractions and amusement parks and things like that. But, you know, sometimes because the ADA really doesn't dive too deep into those types of issues, you're going to find that it is not always going to be to your liking.
Mm-hmm. And yet if a family group has one person who needs those accommodations and they're constantly running into barriers, that whole group is not going to choose to come back.
Right. The vacation I recommend, there's a couple. Number one, I recommend cruising. People with disabilities actually, according to our study, cruise more often than people with the non-disabled counterparts. The people, it's a great vacation because it's in a contained area, and a lot of cruise ships realize that with the aging population being a big part of their market, they realize that this is an industry they want to go to. And there's even some of their wholesalers, like Vacations to Go, who have dedicated teams to help you plan an accessible cruise, from flying down there to the hotel you might stay at the night before, to getting on the ship, to getting off the ship. The other one I recommend is something that I know you're going to do, which is safari. If you can afford to go safari, there are great accessible safaris and other adventure travel across the globe, from hiking and skiing to safaris and mountain biking, if you can ride a bike.
That sounds really cool.
Let's take a little break here. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Powerful Patient at powerfulpatient.org on webtalkradio.net. Please go to our website, where you will find information about the people that we're interviewing and more about the topics that we're covering. You can also make a donation there to the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Bring us back another day, and thank you very much for your support. We're talking with Eric Lipp of the Open Doors organization.
Now, that brings up another issue, and that is the accessibility of those little bathrooms on the airplane that are about the size of a phone booth. I was speaking with a friend the other day who went with his wife to Mexico while he was recovering from spinal surgery, and he's in a wheelchair, you know, hopefully not permanently, but nonetheless, for this trip, he was in a wheelchair for the first time in his life, and the crew said, oh, no problem, we'll just put you in one of those wheelchairs that's small enough to go up and down the aisle, we'll take you down to the bathroom, but then he said to me, so what am I supposed to do when I get in there? You know, I can't stand up, I can't transfer. What hints do you have for someone in that position?
Well, first I'll say there's some good news on the horizon. In fact, we work pretty close with Boeing, and right now I can tell you that the new Dreamliner, the long-haul flight, the 787 that they've come out with, the bathroom is more closely based on universal design principles. So there are going to be accessible restrooms on it, so that's a really good news.
Yay.
However, right now, you know, it's still difficult on the flights on 737s and some of the Airbus 320s, and those are still going to be challenging. You know, all airlines and are required to, by law, the Air Carrier Access Act, which is separate from the ADA, and it regulates airlines. Mm-hmm. And they are required to have on board wheelchair for you to transfer into to get to the restroom. But like you said, a lot of the restrooms aren't accessible. So, yes, it's very difficult. Help is on the way, but I think we're a few years out before that's going to get fully taken care of. And I really expect it to be troublesome on your short-haul flights, single-aisle aircraft, or regional jets are very difficult for using the restroom. It's difficult for anybody, so.
Right, and hopefully it's a short enough flight that you can manage without it.
You're really going to have to plan ahead. That's the best advice we always give to people, is plan ahead.
Right, because it's much easier to do the bathrooming in the airport than in the airplane. But, for example, I have a trip coming up. I'm going to Johannesburg, which
right.
is very exciting. And just booking this flight was very interesting, because on a couple of the airlines, they offered a through flight from New York or from Washington, D.C., 17 hours of travel. So 17 hours in a little airplane. Well, a big airplane. But with a one-hour refueling stop in Dakar, where they don't even let you off the plane. Now, 17 hours in one of those little metal cigars felt to me like a recipe for claustrophobia, even though I can use the bathroom.
Right.
Now, for someone in a wheelchair, what are you going to do?
Wow. It's very difficult. You know, especially because overseas, some of those airlines don't have to adhere to any kind of laws that ours do.
Mm-hmm.
So my best advice is plan ahead.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we did was we found two offerings, one that connects through London and had an 8 to 10 hour layover. And we said, well, good. Longer is better than shorter. And that would break the trip in half and give us time to have a nice break and a walk around in the airport. And there's another that connects through Amsterdam and has a shorter layover, and we actually booked through Amsterdam. But that at least breaks it in half, so now you're down to 8 hours, but still, planning ahead for something that length is going to be hard.
Right. You know, it is real difficult. One of the things we always recommend to people is to find direct flights. If you can fly direct, that's the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not always feasible, however.
Right, especially when you're going such a long distance.
Right.
The shorter flights, and maybe, you know, plan an itinerary where you spend a few days in London or Amsterdam and then pick up and do the next part.
Yeah. Overseas is going to be a challenge, and if you're traveling with a service animal, a relief area for the service animal is going to be something that you really have to consider as well.
Yes. Yes, I've traveled with a guide dog, and when I did, I took some of those little potty pads with me, thinking, we think we're going to be okay, but just in case it's one of those days when you spend 4 hours sitting on the tarmac, I needed a backup plan. And having an animal with you is similarly a challenge. Now,
yeah, and let me just say one thing to that.
Sure.
If you're flying overseas with a service animal, you also have to make sure that company will accept your service animal.
And that the country will as well.
Right. Make sure you bring along the proper vaccinations and paperwork that you might need.
Right.
You will need some.
Yes.
In most foreign countries, yes.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about one other thing, and that is that for long-haul flights, they always recommend that you get up and walk around and make sure that you don't get blood clots from sitting too long in one position, especially with the air pressure issues of airline travel. It's not healthy not to be moving your legs for that long. For someone in a wheelchair, that presents some special challenges. My own guidelines to me were drink lots of water, and then I have to get up once an hour to go pee, and that means that I'm walking to the bathroom and back, and that so it's exercise and hydration. But how does someone in a wheelchair deal with exercise and hydration on a long-haul flight?
Oh, well, you got to be sure that you get an aisle seat, because you should get up and get around. You know, I wear tights. I wear these tights. They're really they're white. You know, they're not attractive by any means, but they usually do the trick for me on long haul flights. You should talk to an occupational therapist or physical therapist if you're in physical therapy to get some ideas.
So, like elastic stockings or something like that.
Right.
Ah, good idea. We were thinking about leg massage or moving legs.
Well, if you could bring a leg masseuse with you, that would be ideal.
Yeah, if your partner's willing to help do that.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was thinking whenever we get up to go to the bathroom, we should exercise our legs or something. Yeah. Because it is an issue, and it is something that people should think about.
Yes, for sure.
Right. And then with hydration, again, what goes in comes out. So you have to figure out what balance is going to work for you. When you take a long airplane flight like that, it dries out your body.
Oh.
So you really need to take a lot of fluids. Like what I normally do is take both a water and an orange juice every time they come around to try to make sure that I don't dry out. But if you're in a situation where the bathroom issue is there, and you don't want to drink too much liquid because you don't want to have to expel it, then do you Do you like drink water before you get on that flight for several days to just make sure that your body's well hydrated before you go through that?
Yeah, you know, for sure you can drink water before. But I don't not recommend drinking water while you're in flight. I think it's really important to continue to do that, even though it might be a challenge to use the restroom.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important to stay hydrated, and you're going to feel a lot better when you get to where you're going, and it'll help you the next day as well. So I actually recommend getting really hydrated going into the flight, on the flight, and then when you hit the ground, you will feel a great deal better. I think it might be worth it to stick to a good water regimen. Maybe stay away from things like cranberry juice and some of those stuff, and stick to water. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I don't hesitate to say drink enough.
Right, and to stay away from caffeine and alcohol, because actually those are drying.
Right.
Any other hints for travelers on how to plan an itinerary? How do you find these accessible hotels and accessible safaris and other adventures like that?
Yeah, that's another thing. I wish I could say it was easy to do all of that, but it's not. One of the best things to use is the web. The web is probably one of the greatest resources for you. But use the web as your first, you know, your first choice to look for information. But I highly recommend that you also contact any property that you'll be staying at or any airline you'll be flying. Try and find a travel agent. It's hard to find travel agents that know a lot about accessible travel, so you're going to have to do some of it on your own, and I think that's why our internet numbers are so high. But places like Vacations to Go, who work really hard accessible cruises, and Land and Shore Excursions, I think they're a great group to work with. I think that there's East Coast Touring does great motor coach tours, as well as use the web. You can find accessible safaris out there, if you can believe it. You can use places like Open Doors to find out information about accessible safaris or travel agents. And don't ever hesitate to ask your friends where they have stayed, because if they have a disability, they're usually the best source of information that you can use.
Right, it comes pre-approved, so to speak.
Exactly.
Well, I think your idea about calling the property to make sure that their idea of accessible is your idea of accessible, I think that's a very good idea.
Yep.
Because, as you say, sometimes they may have a roll-in shower, but the controls are at the opposite end from the bench.
And you know what? Keep one other thing in mind when you're traveling. Take any medication or anything that you might need and carry it on.
Carry it on board with you.
Carry it on board with you.
And these days, because of the liquids and gels, there are a couple of extra pieces of paper that you may need to get those on, right?
Yep.
So a note from your doctor or the prescription bottle that it came in and things like that.
I usually just make a list. I usually write down a list of all my prescriptions with the number to the pharmacy.
And the reason for that is that you can get delays, just like spending 4 hours sitting on the tarmac. You may not get to your destination at the time that you expected to.
Exactly.
Right. And you need to have that extra stuff with you to make sure that you could hang out for another 6 or 12 hours even.
You have to make sure that you cover your time well.
Well, and the other issue is that your suitcase might get lost. They don't usually. Usually it's just delayed. If they lose track of it, they usually find it within 12 hours. But nonetheless, you might need to be able to cope with without that suitcase with your medications.
Yep. And we all know that it's very possible to lose your suitcase on the airline.
Oh, yes. We all have adventure stories like that.
Exactly.
But fortunately, they rarely lose it for permanently. But nonetheless, make a backup plan.
Exactly.
Any other good hints, Eric? This is great.
Yeah. If you're traveling, one more thing, if you're traveling with a power chair or scooter, I highly recommend that you write down instructions on how to use it, on how to remove the batteries and things like that.
So they have to remove the batteries when they stow it?
They don't have to, but sometimes they insist on it. So maybe you have to take your joystick off, or you want to take some things onto the plane with you. You want to be sure that that they have instructions on how to get that back together.
Uh-huh. So maybe even photocopy the manual or something.
Great idea.
Yeah. Super. So, yeah, think about all your devices. Think about your animals. Think about your medications. And the hydration is extremely important. People don't realize how dangerous dehydration can be, but it's a terrible medical complication.
Yeah, and people with disabilities often forget that, especially when they're flying.
I think the other thing that I'd like to say to people is get yourself out of the house. And yes, it takes some work, and you do have to think about it, but it's just so much, so it's good for your own thought processes. It's good for you to avoid depression. You need to be with people. You need to be out there having fun. And go do it.
Yeah, I agree. Get out of the house. When we spend our money, we get more services.
That's true, too. So, and there are now a lot of accessible places. There are businesses that are working at this, and we need to, when we do run into somebody who's doing it well, I think it's important to thank them. Let them know that you noticed.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything else that you would want to say to folks?
No. I hope everybody has good, safe travels.
Thanks, Eric. This has been great. I appreciate you doing this with us.
Thanks, Joyce.
We've been speaking with Eric Lipp of the Open Doors organization in Chicago. Stay with us now, and we'll speak with Althea Johnson and Angela D'Arezzo about their experiences with long-distance travel. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back.
So I have with me Angela and Althea. You ladies came to talk with me today about preparing for a very exciting trip that Althea and I are planning in March.
Wow.
We're planning to go to South Africa.
Oh, that is so nice.
Yeah, so it's 17 hours in a plane. To get to Johannesburg, and we have a new affiliate group for von Hippel-Lindau disease that's starting up in South Africa, so we're very excited to go and meet with them. But this is going to be quite a trip. It's going to be one of the longest trips I've ever done, and I think it's one of the longest Althea's ever done, is that
definitely,
right?
Definitely.
What's the longest trip you've done so far?
Oh, maybe to Hawaii. That was like, 6 hours or so?
Yeah.
Well,
probably two legs, one to California, which is, 4 hours or more, 6 hours, and then another leg on to Hawaii that's another 4 to 6 hours.
Mm-hmm. I think it was about 8 hours.
So this time we were trying to figure out what's the healthiest way for us to go, and especially one of the things I was concerned about is that they always tell you to walk around to avoid clotting in your legs. But for someone who's using a wheelchair, that's not exactly an option. So Althea tells me that you've done some long distance travel as well.
Yes, I have, it's not that easy. Depending, I mean, I traveled to Italy, and that was only 8 hours, and I traveled to Venezuela, but that wasn't really so bad. It was about 4 or 5 hours.
But that's a good long stint, and the way we booked this is with a layover in Amsterdam in the middle, so we have essentially 2 8-hour stints.
Oh, okay, so that's maybe, that's a little bit better.
Yeah, we wanted to try to break it a little bit.
Yeah, it's just that, my legs got so swollen. I thought I wasn't going to, I use a wheelchair, but I'm ambulatory with help. I use a walker in the house, and I had my personal care assistant with me, and I thought I wasn't going to be able to stand. It's like, you know, all the fluid, it's just going down to your ankles. There's no movement, and, you know, you have to get prepared for that. But actually, I put, what was it? I asked, I got a blanket from the stewardess, right, and my PCA, which is personal care assistant, and she gave it to me, and I kind of, like, raised up.
You used that as a footrest.
Yes, I used it as a footrest. It wasn't hard enough, but, I mean, it did help a little bit.
I was speaking to a physical therapist, and she suggested those tight stockings. I don't know what they're called right now.
Sort of elastic stockings.
The elastic stockings. Oh, that's another option. I haven't used them, but...
I have never used them either, but... I'm going to try them.
Well, just to clarify for everybody, the issue is that normally our blood pumps from our heart down into our legs. And then when we move our leg muscles, it's the action of those muscles that pumps the blood back up into our heart. And if we're not moving around, then we don't have that action to move it back. So that's why the fluid is pooling in your legs. You know, they tell everybody on the plane to curl your toes or do little knee lifts or do something like that. Obviously, if you have less movement in your lower limbs, then that becomes problematic. So with your personal care assistant there, did you have someone helping move your legs at all?
Yes, I had start to, like, you know, switch position for me because it's impossible to be in one position for such a long time.
Right.
For me, it is anyway.
Sure.
And, you know, another thing, it's like if you could move your toes, you could do, like, ankle pumps even though you're sitting.
Right.
So that kind of pumps a little bit, you know, pumps the blood up.
That's right.
That doesn't work for me. When I went to Hawaii, I did have a little clonus. And, you know, a lot of doctors say, oh, poor thing, you have clonus. But I really appreciated that clonus because that was movement. You know, I couldn't control it, really.
What is a clonus?
It's just like an involuntary muscle movement.
A sort of spasm?
It causes the legs to jump. Like you're dancing, you know, like hot tamales or hot peppers or something. You just dance around. Your legs just jump up and down. And I appreciated that because I tell you, I believe that really helped me.
Right.
But now that is a thing of the past. I get a little jump every now and then in one of my legs, but the other one is as quiet as a church mouse. So I really do need to find something that's going to work for me. And I think the idea of putting my feet up on a blanket or something else hard is a good idea for that ride.
Right.
Getting those elastic stockings.
What other tips would you have, Angela?
Well, I have a problem because my legs do swell up, my ankles, from, I guess, sitting and not moving. At home, I have an electric bed, which, you know, the feet go up and the head and everything, it's modified. But when you go somewhere else, and especially in another country, I mean, these things are not available. So what I did, I took a chair and I turned it upside down and I put it on the bed. I put a pillow on top of the chair and I raised my legs up there. To kind of, you know, like make believe it's my bed that it's raised up. Just to have some relief.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Well, and you can always ask for more pillows.
Yeah, but the thing is that the pillows are soft.
And after a while, they tend to move. They'll either sink down or they'll squish out.
So it's not, it's like you need something hard, and the only thing I could think of that was available was the chair.
Good idea. And you could probably use one of your own suitcases, too.
Yes, you can use a suitcase. I thought about that afterwards. That's a good thing, too. Anything that can be raised and, you know, it's hard.
It's a little
maybe put a pillow on top to make it more comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that works.
So in other words, invent something.
But I think when someone has a disability, it's like it's such a necessity that your mind just comes up with this in these things. You just invent them.
Mm-hmm. What about inflatables? Because they would pack flat, but have you used any kind of inflatables that might help you for a prop?
A PT once gave me an inflatable, like, pillow. It was kind of a bolster. And I found that it did the same thing that a bunch of pillows would do. Mm-hmm. While it wouldn't squish down all the way because it was inflated and it was air and the air couldn't get out, after a while it started to push away from me.
Mm.
You know, my feet started to go down because it just started to push. I guess if you have, like, a footboard at the foot of your bed, it can't go anywhere, but I don't have that, so it kind of pushed away after a while.
Right. Mm. I suppose, you know, you could browse the inflatables in the toy department and see if there's something that would be the right size or shape
assist
you.
We're speaking with Althea Johnson and Angela D'Arezzo from the International Center for the Disabled in New York. We're going to take a little break here, and we'll be right back to talk some more about long-distance travel.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back. We're talking with Althea Johnson and Angela D'Arezzo about long-distance travel.
Well, I have a personal question for you, Angela.
Yes.
When you were on the plane, how did you get to the bathroom?
I didn't. I prepare myself psychologically, and I don't drink. I just take, like, little sips to
keep your
moist my mouth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mouth, my throat, and I keep candies, and I really go to the bathroom, like, before I'm going to get onto the plane, like, a little bit before.
Mm-hmm.
I make sure I just go, even if I feel I don't have to go, I go, because even a drop is going to matter if it's a long distance. So, but actually, what a you know, if it's a long, long distance, I will protect myself. Just to be sure, I would buy, like, what are those things called, Altira, those adult Pampers?
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, just for your own protection, because if you should have an accident, then
they're
you're protected.
They're called adult briefs now.
I forgot what they're called. Because I don't use them, so I'm not sure what they're called. But, I thought about that also. I guess if I should travel, I think I will probably do something like that just in case.
Mm-hmm.
But I would still, I wouldn't
drink. They even have the pull-ups for adults now.
Oh, okay. I know they have a lot of things, but since I'm not, you know, I don't use them, I really haven't looked around. But it does work. It's necessary. But 17 hours, oh my God.
Well, 8 and 8, and that's
eight.
Uh-huh. One of the reasons we broke it in the middle was exactly for that reason.
For that reason,
yeah. Well, now, the other thing, though, that I'm concerned about, if you're not drinking very much on an airplane, airplane travel is very drying.
And dehydrated.
And dehydration is a very serious medical problem. So I would at least want you to drink a lot of water for the week before.
Yeah.
Oh, no, but I drink a lot. I mean, I drank up to the day before.
Yeah.
I drank.
Yeah.
So I'm not, you know, I don't want to let people think that, you know, they shouldn't drink because then, you know, we don't want anybody to get sick.
That's right.
I mean, I drink. If it's my plane flight, it's in the evening. I drink during the day.
Right.
I just make sure, like, a couple of hours before that I start emptying, you know, the bladder.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, you know, I mean, drinking is very important.
And I also, you know, when I'm on trips like that, I will drink a little water, a little sip of cranberry juice or something, have some ice to wet my whistle.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that on this trip, they talk about staying hydrated and keeping the nasal passages moist. I have a saline nasal spray that I was going to bring along and just keep those areas moist, but try not to drink too much because, you know, I don't want to bust.
Right. That's a great idea. And some sort of lip moisturizer you might want to take, or and a hand cream. And make sure that all those are in small containers that fit into that quart-sized Ziploc plastic bag these days.
Yeah, isn't that something? That's unbelievable.
Well, actually, I always carry my bottle of water with me wherever I go.
Well,
even
the problem
you
is...
carry it on the plane. You can't buy it after you pass
that's
through
right.
the... You can't carry it with...
You can't carry it through security, but you can buy it afterward and take it on the plane. And they do have water on board, too.
They do, yes,
yeah.
They do.
Those are great ideas.
Oh, the only thing that I find is that a lot of the flight attendants or whatever, they're still not very educated on disability.
Well, let me tell you two stories. Number one. I've been on plenty of planes. I'm not a lot, but plenty, especially since the wheelchair. And I had one stewardess, a guy, says, now, if there's an emergency, what's the best thing we can do to help you get off the plane? And I looked at him and said, well, I don't know. What do you think? You know? And he says, well, what we usually do is put a sheet on the seat and then sit you on the sheet so that we can just lift up the sheet if we have to get you out of here quickly. I says, well, do whatever you need to do to get me out of here fast. The first and only stewardess or steward that said that to me, ever.
Great.
Wow, nobody
ever. And then one time we landed, and I'm waiting for the aisle chair. And I'm waiting, and I'm waiting. Everybody is off the plane. The plane is dark now. And one stewardess comes from the back and says, well, miss, we've landed. You have to get off the plane now. I said, well, as soon as you get me an aisle chair, I'll be glad to. So that's how educated and uneducated they are. And I think it just depends on your luck.
Mm.
Yeah.
When you get.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're trying, but, you know, they're not really sensitive to it.
Well, somebody told me about CRO, and I'm not sure now what those initials stand for, but if you have a concern, especially if you're disabled, if you ask for the CRO, they have to come and resolve the issue, and every airline has one available. They're supposed to have one available, and if they don't, then that's a big fine for the airline. So they have somebody available that can address an issue.
A CRO is a complaint resolution officer.
But I know what you mean by you can read somebody's attitude sometimes, and sometimes they're open to learning a little bit, and then sometimes they want to act as if they know it all.
Mm.
So sometimes it's really not worth the battle.
Yeah.
Plus, they're kind of in charge, and they can make your trip, you know,
miserable.
Very uncomfortable.
Yeah, so as much as possible, it would be a good idea to try to make a pleasant relationship with those people and maybe try to help them learn a little bit, because especially if you're going to spend the next 8 hours on their airplane, mm-hmm. you don't want to have a contentious relationship with them if
right,
you can avoid
right.
it.
To Boston and Washington, I took the Amtrak.
Mm-hmm.
They were excellent.
My Amtrak trip to Boston was good, too.
They were so good with my wheelchair, with sitting me in the right place, and they gave me enough room for my feet. It was just great. I was like, oh.
When I went to Boston on Amtrak in my wheelchair, they first of all held the train for me because the elevator or something to go down to the platform was not working. So the guy had to go all around town to get me downstairs, and the train was there and about to pull off. He said, hold the train, and got me on there. And then the conductor, he made one guy move for me. He says,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, mister, this space is reserved for wheelchair users. Made him get up. He had gotten all comfortable and pulled out his papers and everything. He was really ticked, but he had to move. And I had the most comfortable trip.
Mm-hmm. Amtrak is great.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is the training that they go through, and part of it, I think, is also the regulations. I spoke with Eric Lipp earlier, and he mentioned that in the United States there are laws now and sensitivity trainings and things like that,
mm-hmm.
and they're not as prevalent in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Did you find a difference between Italy and the United States in that regard?
Oh, yes. Actually, that's the reason why, because I was born in Italy, and I came here when I was young, I was about 10 years old, and I hadn't gone back for that reason, because it's now wheelchair accessible,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the roads there, it's not like the United States, they like to, you know, roads with no sidewalks, and I was like, how am I going to do this? Mm-hmm. And I went with a manual wheelchair instead of my motorized, because they're no curb cuts.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing is that people were great. I mean, they were willing to help you without me even asking. So that was like, oh, at least I feel I'm protected,
mm-hmm.
you know, by the people. But it was just, it was kind of difficult. You needed someone there to really help you with the chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish that I could go with my motorized wheelchair, I am not. The guy that helped me, the occupational therapist, said, you know, take your manual chair, because they are not going to treat your chair the way you would treat it. And it'll be down there and bouncing all around, and you'll get it back, and you won't be able to move it.
Mm.
So it's better to take your manual chair. And I was thinking maybe of renting a motorized chair, if that was possible when I got there. You know, I'll have
like
to look into
idea.
That.
Well, that sounds like a good idea, because
right.
then you'll be more independent.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It would be nice to be able to move around, you know, a little bit by myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, and when we're in the cities, there should be modern enough and accessible enough buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Angela, did you stay in hotels in Italy, or did you stay with family?
I stood in a hotel in two different places.
Now, how did you select hotels, and did you find the accessibility you were looking for?
Well, that's another story. Well, now we're talking about Italy, which I love, but things there are not as accessible or advanced as we are in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I went to the hotel, they call it the bathroom accessible, and there was like a little bench. I think maybe a baby will fit there. It wasn't what's called accessible for me. It's not the way it is for them.
in the United States, you can call the hotel and say, do you have an ADA bathroom, you know, in the hotel? And generally, that's understood to mean a particular thing. But you may still need to call out the specific things that you need to have in that room and just double-check with them that they're going to be there.
Oh, yes, because one time I went, I don't remember where, but I said I wanted to make sure the room was wheelchair accessible, and he said yes. I said, well, I said, is the door, the entrance, the door to get in into the room, is it the door, is it wide that my wheelchair would fit? And they said, yes, it's wide enough. They just made it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's like when we were in Chicago, Joyce. I got in the room okay, and I got in that bathroom okay. I mean, my manual wheelchair was scraping the sides of the entryway into the bathroom. But I could not get out of that bathroom. I was beginning to panic. And after I had tried, Fred and I had tried for 5 minutes or so, he thought, well, let me pull you out backwards and see. And I barely got out of that bathroom. And by the time we came back from lunch, they had taken something off the door so that I could get in easier.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I had asked for a wheelchair-accessible room, and that's what they gave me.
Well, and I think it's important to raise the visibility of an issue like that, too, so that they'll pay attention and fix it for the next person.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important because a lot of people in, I mean, in the world, whether they're young or older, I mean, there's a lot of disabled people. People just become disabled even in their middle ages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes,
being able now doesn't mean you're not going to be disabled later, or even a family member,
And we have a lot of veterans coming back from the war. So, yeah, I think it's important to raise this visibility. And the other thing is that people with handicaps are a lot more mobile these days than they have been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
They get up and go in a way that we didn't two or three decades ago.
That's true.
No, that's very true, yeah.
Yeah. Well, another problem in older countries is that the buildings are so much older. I went to a meeting in France, and they had said the conference room was wheelchair accessible. And that it was in a 16th century castle.
Oh, my God.
And they had built a modern conference center in the basement of it. And they did have an elevator, but the elevator was about the size of your average phone booth. And you could just get your wheelchair person in there. Nobody else could possibly get in with them. So we'd push the button, run downstairs, meet the wheelchair person at the bottom. And then after you got out on that level, there were three steps to go down to get into the conference center.
And said, no ramp.
Why not a ramp? You know, it was just lack of sensitivity. And able people sometimes just simply don't realize that if you're in a wheelchair, you're sitting down trying to use that water fountain, trying to use that telephone, that there's so many things that we're just not tuned into unless you've had the experience or and someone has brought it to your attention. So I think we're all getting tuned in, but it's a gradual process. And thank you for your help in raising some of these issues.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, peak places are not as accessible as what you're used to. So just be prepared for, you know, a little more inconvenience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's part of the adventure, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you, ladies. This has been really a lot of fun.
Well, you're welcome.
So I guess the bottom line is the scout motto of be prepared. We don't know exactly what they had, but we try as much as possible to foresee issues that might crop up, either relative to our medical condition or to the circumstances that we're going to be encountering on our adventure, and we try to be prepared. Be sure to check out the program guide that goes with this show, as we have additional information there for you and my favorite checklist of things to take with you on a long-distance flight. In the airplane, the most important thing is to avoid getting a cold, because everybody's airborne germs are floating around in that airplane, and that's one of the main reasons that you want to stay hydrated and keep your nasal passages moist so that the little germs don't have any cracks to get in through. Next week, we're going to talk with two people who have been advocates for a child and for a friend, and how is being an advocate different from being a caregiver. So we'll learn more about being an advocate, and you might think about circumstances where you might be an advocate or that you might need one. So join us next week, and we'll talk with you some more. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient.